almost everything that arises from these false basic attitudes, taking the life away from the simple dignities, the simple humanities that make things valuable. If, therefore, you are not careful, you can get into trouble. Now, here's another general phase of the matter which also has its problems, and that is the effect upon health. We've spoken about a little about the emotional and mental stress of these situations. Now let's speak about the physical, the possible damage that is done physically as a result of some of these procedures. Nearly all metaphysical practices involve a certain amount of stress. They create various kinds of fixed tensions of one kind or another. Most forms of concentration will do this in time. The individual, whether he realizes it or not, subjects his nervous system, particularly the autonomic system, to a tremendous amount of stress. The moment the confusion is set up in our relationships with life, the nervous system begins to flutter, because the nervous system is very close to fear, anxiety, uncertainty, unreasonable hope, and the ups and downs of one minute of despair and the next minute of exaltation, the individual believing everything one moment and nothing the next moment, more or less disoriented much of the time, and becoming more and more hypersensitive, more and more defensive, because he is increasingly misunderstood by everybody else. Little by little, his life becomes miserable, unhappy, unadjusted, tension-ridden, stress-torn. And in a very reasonable length of time, the physical situation begins to reveal itself. It is very hard for the person to be under fear, anxiety, or intense imagination without punishing the bodily structure too much. So these people begin to experience lack of normal body functions. Respiration may become erratic. Various forms of tachycardia may develop. Elimination may get very bad. And most of all, we have the person who develops what I have often referred to as psychic flutters. This is an ailment in itself which is almost uniquely due to psychosomatic symbolism. It is the gradual development within the personality of strange, unexplainable miseries, as we used to call them, particularly in the Deep South. They were often referred to as miseries, sometimes a little further north as agonies. But in any case, they were difficulties. Where most persons who have these psychic problems report strange feelings. They report motions moving inside of them. Something like nerve filaments crawling under the skin. They describe something resembling the grand symbolism of the metapause. Almost any mysterious, eccentric, uncomfortable, distressing feeling. They will have all the cold chills and hot flashes there are in the book. They will feel things moving up and down their spines, think their eyes are crossed, have trouble in swallowing, strange, mysterious, moving migraines in various parts of the body, They will develop symptoms of arthritis one moment and of arteriosclerosis the next. They haven't any of them. But they are suffering from palpitations, flutterations, and everything you can think of. And they are sure, almost certain, that these different things all indicate the presence of some kinds of strange entities that are creeping up at them when they're not looking, scratching them when they're trying to relax, whispering unpleasant words into their ears when they're trying to sleep, tormenting their rest with dreams and visions that are not nice and not pleasant, and creating every kind of a nerve reflex that people do not enjoy. This is a very common group of symptoms. I could list hundreds of related symptoms in this area, but I think we have summed it up sufficiently to point out the general theme. To these people, all of these symptoms seem to signify the presence of some other entity, being, force, nature, or substance affecting them. Perhaps they think that some of these mysterious feelings are other people's thoughts bouncing off of them or something. But as always, this type of thing begins to develop. I think the real answer to it is a gradual psychosomatic transference of total confusion. The individual has lost completely orientation. And perhaps if we can imagine that the nervous system, under such complete psychic breakdown, simply loses its own rhythms and its own orderly processes and begins to take on some similitude of the prevailing lack of organization and integration. In any event, we find that a large amount of psychic phenomena ends up with this. Sometimes it gets so bad that there seems to be very little you can do for it. The one thing that might help you can't do in the majority of instances, and that is get the individual to change his own mental habits. By this time, he is so convinced that he has no power over the situation that all he wants is a sorcerer to get rid of demons for him. He doesn't have any realization that these symptoms indicate the breakdown of his own natural integration. He is not mentally ill. He is physically disturbed, symbolically. All the mysterious doubts and wonders and hopes and anxieties that developed psychically are now playing themselves out nervously in the functions of the body. And this is an unpleasant thing to have happen. And the moment anybody feels any of these symptoms, stop worrying about what other people are doing to you and start organizing your own resources as quickly as you can. By organizing your own resources, I mean simply get your mind on practical, workable levels of action, train your thinking, control your emotions, find natural and reasonable outlets, and get your mind off of being spiritual. Because if you don't, you're going to have more trouble. Obviously, an individual in this condition is not spiritual. Therefore, whatever method has been used to get into trouble is not the method they should be following if they wish to become wise. So there's no use continuing the present policy. It is obviously wrong, or the individual wouldn't be in trouble all the time. This, again, is a problem that affects good people, people who have tried very hard, but who have lost a certain sense of security. They have been thrown out into a universe that is too big for them, and they weren't smart enough to swim to shore as quickly as possible. And most of these people must learn to swim to shore. And to start all over again in the effort to establish a basic groundwork for self-improvement. We often find that other factors do contribute to this situation. Nearly every religious organization and most people involved in them become gradually more or less unnatural in their personal ways of living. They get into trouble this way also, unfortunately. We have all kinds of trick diets. We have all kinds of special exercises. We have individuals forcibly removed or deprived of the common expressions of life which have been theirs over a period of years. We find them gradually developing various frustrations on the ground that the more frustrated they are, the more spiritual they are. This is a good way to get good and sick quick, because the human being cannot take these inconsistent procedures without having some background for them. Now, it is true that every so often you will find a hermit or an old saint in legend, lore, or actual history, perhaps, who has gone away into the desert, into the mountains, or into the forest, and there built his hermitage, and has lived peacefully and quietly apart from the concerns of man, and has practiced his Tao or his Zen or his yoga for half a lifetime in perfect peace and tranquility. Nothing unfortunate ever happened to him so far as we know, but sometimes we're not quite sure how far we know. But at the same time, the rumors are that he's done well. Now, this is all right. It's quite understandable. There are people like this in every human society. There are individuals who are born for the cloisters and are never happy till they go there. There are people who have always wanted to live strange lives of unselfish dedication to other people. They're really most content in some field of religious service. They have no strong attachments to worldliness. They find material living uncomfortable and unpleasant. They do not want to run away into doing nothing, so they would rather live in a dedicated service to some cause. And many of these people are very useful, and they do wonderful jobs. But they are generally useful and do well under the strong supervision of a system. And they become teachers of the young, or nurses of the sick, or guardians of the aged, or something of this nature. But they live and function, and their religious life is dedicated to rather practical, commonplace labors, which they perform in the name of their higher spiritual ideals. Now, this, in many instances, works out very well. But to take everyone, to take people from here and there and everywhere, and impose these kind of restrictions on them, will most certainly end in psychological and probably physical disorder. These people are not so constituted that such a program is reasonable or practical for them. This is what happened in the development of Buddhism, where the Southern school divided from the Northern school. The Southern school taught distinctly and definitely that there was only one way to achieve illumination, and that was to leave the world completely, utterly, and immediately, and never come back again. To turn from the common life to the robe. To give up every possession, to give up every attachment, to give up every worldly attitude, and even every worldly responsibility. And go out with a begging bowl and one small square of cloth. And keep on wandering and meditating until consciousness or death ended the procedure. This was not, however, the Buddhism that gradually unfolded the great arts, the great cultures, the great mystics and idealists of the Mahayana system. Man gradually came to realize that somehow the great spiritual truths had to be brought within the range of his common life. It became necessary for him to think of the way of liberation for the householder, that the father and mother with children and family and business had to have their part in this great pattern of enlightenment. That it wasn't to leave everything and to depart into the unknown, but in some mysterious way to increase in grace, insight, and understanding every day, to find in the commonplace the source of enlightenment and inspiration, and also to realize that for the majority of mankind, simple idealistic devotion to principles was the wisest and best way to grow. That sometimes, if the person had the internal requisites, if he had brought forward with him from some previous life a degree of insight that called for the development of some extrasensory perception, it would come in due time of itself. And, of course, in the northern Buddhist system, that was the last thing anybody asked for or expected. They did not practice their religion in the hopes that some initiation or mystical experience would occur to them. They practiced their religion because they believed that their religion was the proper way of life, that if they lived this and lived it well, and kept the law, they would fulfill their responsibility to God and themselves. The whole purpose underlying this religious philosophy was not the unfoldment of the individual primarily. It was obedience to the law, the glorification of truth by keeping its rules and principles, and keeping them unselfishly, not in hope of enlightenment, but because this was the proper labor of an enlightened human being. Under such conditions, we do know that there were mystics and great mystics arise among these different groups. But these mystics were persons who had slowly unfolded. They had lived each step of the common life. They had grown skillful and wise in the philosophy of the doctrine. They had gone out and dedicated themselves to the service of others over long periods of time. They had gained practical insight as working with the sick and as helping to solve the problems of the burdened. They had become the counselors of rulers and the friends of princes. They had helped in the creation of good laws. They had helped to perfect arts and sciences. Many of them actually gave skills to their peoples. And Kobo Daishi, who was one of the great monks of the Shingonshu in Japan, is accredited with having given almost as many inventions to the Japanese people as Leonardo da Vinci gave to Europe. A tremendous genius in his own right. He was not a person who had simply decided to be spiritual. He had worked and labored and studied. He had lived with the wives. He made the long and at that time dangerous journey to China in order to come closer to the great seats of the doctrines. He was a master of knowledge, one of the most perfectly informed men of his time, and still regarded as one of the most enlightened men of Asia. These people grew sincerely. They gave everything they had to growth. And they grew not just simply for the sake of being wise themselves, but that they might become the founders of essential and practical movements and organizations. There were great mathematicians, great artists, great musicians, poets, men of literature and letters, And out of the temples and the shrines and the sanctuaries came the great arts, the great modelings and sculpturings, the casting in bronze and in silver. These people were highly skilled. They took the attitude that the more able they became in everyday labor, the more completely they were able to express their spiritual convictions. So that they worked with the law. They became better, realizing that the reward of being better is to know more. The reward of greater daily virtue is enlightenment. That there are really no tricks in this thing at all. By the time they reached the point, as in Zenshu or in the Shingonshu or Tendaishu, where certain esoteric disciplines were recommended or given to them by their teachers, these disciples were so well grounded in every principle of ethics, in their knowledge of the universal structure and the operations of all the laws of nature, that it would be virtually impossible for them to make a mistake. They had all the groundwork in, all the principles thoroughly established. Usually, in Zen, not much of an esoteric nature was divulged under 20 years of discipleship. And that discipleship was more rigorous than anything that we can imagine. It was constant self-analysis. The breaking down of every illusion and delusion in consciousness. And by the time the disciple was ready to go on, he had truly cleaned his own inner life. It was well-disciplined and well-ordered. People that have this degree of insight can probably be trusted, and you seldom, if ever, hear of anyone in this type of level of activity whoever perverted what he knew or contributed to the corruption of anyone else. These people knew, and they were able to use their knowledge wisely. What we are worried about constantly and stricken about so often is the dabbler, the one who really tries, but simply doesn't even have a comprehension of what he's trying. To him, a few lessons and a couple of books, and he's well on his way to nirvana. It just doesn't operate that way. This does not mean, however, that the individual cannot grow. He can grow continuously. But he has to grow with a dedication, not an enthusiasm alone. He has to grow along the line which is the most difficult of all forms, and that is self-discipline and self-control. I know more people who have tried to be spiritual without taking hold of their own lives. They can do almost anything you can imagine except what they should be doing, and that is controlling and directing their own conduct. These people are perfectly willing to devote a great deal of time to wandering about the cosmos, but they cannot be patient as people. They do not know how. They cannot really be thoughtful. I know many of them that cannot even be commonly courteous. There is no attention to personal character. This is something to be left behind, to be hurdled, to be considered fit only for persons of less spiritual insight. There is no spiritual insight apart from character. There is no safe mystical experience apart from character. There is no possibility of man exploring the inner universe of value safely unless his own integrity is completely established. Any other course of procedure is bound to lead ultimately to difficulty. And because no one but the individual himself knows the degree of his insight, each person has to come to some way of judging these things. You cannot tell him that he isn't ready. He will keep on going around until he finds someone else who tells him he is ready. And this goes on, because the person wants to believe that he's on the verge of enlightenment. He doesn't want to be told he hasn't started yet. So you can't convince people against their will. And yet, because of this peculiar type of religious thinking that has developed, people just get themselves into trouble and have no way out. And by the time they realize the degree of their trouble, the very persons who got them into the trouble can't do a thing for them. So they wander about hoping for someone who can perform a miracle and rescue them from the dilemma into which they have gotten themselves. But this time, perhaps they do have a little experience. It will serve them in good stead in due time, but at the moment they're in a very uncomfortable state about the whole thing. So we can only profoundly warn the individual that when he starts dabbling with mysterious things, he must either have the consciousness to handle these things, or he should leave them alone. And no one who is frightened out of his wits by every psychic wind that blows is in a condition to handle the problem. No one who has to seek help is in a condition to handle it. Therefore, if this situation seems to be developing, there can be only one answer. Get out of it as quickly as you possibly can and get your feet back on the ground again. Use the simple ways. Realize that this whole problem of what you might term psychic involvement is only possible at all because, basically, the person is not capable of thinking with true wisdom. He isn't able to really think straight. Somewhere, weaknesses of his own have contributed to the fact that he was deceived or has deceived himself. It has to start with this. From that point on, all perspective can be lost, and the situation can just be a long, terrible hurt with no really, apparently, satisfactory explanation. But in the beginning, the person had to be foolish. And the only answer is to stop being foolish as quickly as you can. There are ways in which some damage in this area can be rescued, or the individual can be pulled out of his problem. We realize that as the problem gets worse, as the individual advances in some form of psychic persecution, which is more and more difficult for him to get off of his own mind, he is inevitably becoming neurotic. He is becoming fear-ridden. Even if he hasn't reached a degree of hallucination, it may come any moment. He is certainly actually frightened. He is living in fear. The whole thing has become a phobia. And this phobia is nursed. Fear is nursed by fear. The more he worries about his fears, the more he thinks about his fears, the more he waits for new symptoms to appear, the more frightened he will become. And if this goes on, especially if the individual is alone, perhaps living alone, where there is very little contact with other people, too much loneliness to begin with, which may have been a contributing cause in the first place, then this person must either make a valiant break with the situation where he finds himself, or he will not get out of the difficulty. And unfortunately, it is not a difficulty that will cure itself. nor will it get better unless something is done about it. Realizing, therefore, that as in the case of nearly all forms of neurosis, which may come from other causes, there is too much self-attention. The mind and emotions are focused upon the dilemmas of the self constantly. This means that little by little it becomes a 24-hour vigil of psychic self-defense against the unknown. The individual doesn't dare sleep. He doesn't dare do anything because of this constantly increasing pressure of fear, a pressure that is usually accompanied by psychosomatic symptoms that seem so real that there is no way apparently of explaining them except to assume that the psychic persecution is real itself. Under this combination, we have a hard, vicious circle which is extremely difficult to break. The best way that we can solve it is by starting out with the assumption that a pattern is no stronger than its weakest link. The situation is a pattern. If we can break it somewhere, we perhaps can break it everywhere. If we can put new factors into the problem or take old factors out of it, if we can shift the point of view, if we can change the psychic chemistry in some way, then the individual may be able to handle it himself from there on. So we have common things that we try to do to help people in this type of problem. We try to find out anything that they are doing that is unnatural, unreasonable, or likely to contribute to the trouble. If these people are starving themselves to death in the name of religion, we suggest a square meal, but that it be taken slowly, because otherwise they may have dyspepsia. If these individuals have been practicing some form of syncopated breathing or something of this nature, they must stop it, or the situation will not change. If these people have left the world because it is so materialistic and so unspiritual that it is constantly hurting their very, very subtle etheric bodies, we suggest strongly they go back in the world and reestablish contact. That they've got to get out and get back in those good old low vibrations again, because the high ones are killing them. If these people have no interest in life whatsoever except waiting for the next psychic phenomena, we strongly recommend other interests. And we particularly recommend some form of activity which disciplines. If these people are retired on an income or are divorced and living on alimony and don't have to work, they're in a especially bad spot. These people have to decide that they have to work. They have to come to the conclusion that no matter what they have or how much security they enjoy, they will destroy themselves if they are not usefully occupied. We find then the importance of these people training some part of their natures. And the result shows how badly this training is needed, for so frequently these people are completely unable to take up any line of self-discipline without a massive struggle. These individuals cannot go back to school and take some adult education work. It's too monotonous. In other words, they cannot say to themselves, I expect to do this and I will do it. It's part of the very evidence of the trouble they got into. But you've got to get them out of it. They have to have new interests, new activities, practical outlets. They have to take up studies. They have to discipline themselves. If you want to play the piano, you discipline yourself. If you're suffering from a bad psychological or psychic condition, if you're unable to control these vibrations that may or may not be entities, it is simply because of lack of discipline. If you will discipline yourself somewhere, it will show all over you. Therefore, if we can get this individual who has never made up their own mind clearly on any subject in their entire lives, but who thinks they're just on the suburbs of heaven, if you can get this individual to go out and study music for 5 years, doing scales for the first three, and insisting that their own hands and their own minds will do this, or if you can get them into a group of Sumi painters and make them learn to make circles and bamboo joints on paper with black ink for 3 years before they're allowed to put a leaf on them, these people get well. Why? Because they have suddenly learned that they can make their minds and emotions do what is required of them. The person becomes positive. He has some accomplishment. He has some ability. It usually takes from 1 to 3 months for a discipline to become a fascinating thing. The first 2 or 3 months, it is drudgery. But if a person really has some qualities within his own nature, he will develop a growing interest in the new things that are of interest or value to him. So if he can hold on for 2 or 3 months, the subjects will probably take over a large part of his habit mechanism. He will then go on and find that he has learned how to learn. If he will do this and gradually develop disciplines, he will then be able to turn these disciplines to the direct problems that are problemming him. He will be able to turn these disciplines to fear. He will find that he is able to control fear in himself. He will be able to control his own spiritual ambitions and realize that he's probably not quite ready for nirvana. He will be able to recognize that it is possible for him to go home into an empty house, perhaps, and build there a world of interesting values because he has become an interesting person. It is from ourselves that the environment in which we live must radiate. If we are negative, the environment is negative and afflicts us. If we are dynamic in ourselves, the environment in which we find our daily living becomes itself a dynamic source of inspiration. Everywhere the individual achieves his spiritual integration by becoming master of his own instincts, appetites, impulses, and fears. So if we can create in the person new interests, if we can cause this person to become more concerned over someone else than himself. I've known 2 or 3 cases of this spiritual problem in which the individual was suddenly transformed by an unavoidable responsibility. They suddenly realized they had a duty that had to be performed. They rose magnificently to this responsibility, and the psychic problem vanished instantly. But there has to be something bigger than our fears. If we start correctly with our philosophic growth, truth is always bigger than our fears. But too many people live in a universe in which truth is lost. The moment we stop believing in forces of evil persecuting us for no reason, we have betrayed our own faith in the universe. There is no other answer. But we do not know this. We can't think it through anymore. We have lost our perspective. We are simply hurt. And where we are hurt, there is no justice. We have to restore these values. We have to straighten them out and build again a pattern of positive conviction on which we can live. If we can voluntarily reassume responsibilities that we have attempted to avoid, this will also help. It's like the young man who comes in to me and he says, I'm not getting any discipline at home. I'm now graduating from high school. I think the only thing for me to do is to commit myself to the Navy for 3 years and see what they can do with me. The man says, if I don't do this, I will never be able to discipline myself. So perhaps for this young man, the Navy is the perfect thing, because at least he will come out being able to say, yes, sir, and no, sir. Which is more than the average person can do. He will also know that when an order is given, he will obey, which the average child has not discovered. He also realizes that he's part of a team. And if he betrays the team, he is pretty much of a skunk. In civilian life, we don't know this. I have known several instances where young men have done this and have come back a credit to themselves and their families. Would otherwise have been on the street and probably in delinquency from lack of discipline and direction. So where we have a person who finds himself slipping into a negative psychic condition, we have the same thing. Put yourself under discipline. I doubt if the Navy would be interested, but there are other things you can do. You can create your own discipline. And you can say to yourselves, if I fail in this, then I know for certain just how weak I am and how far I am from the thing I think I am. Get these things very straight and very firm in ourselves, and we can generally defeat this psychic problem even after it settles in. But we can never defeat it by trying to use magic against magic. Well, the bigger the invocations and formulas and charms we make, the bigger the other side makes. And if we have the super charm, they have the super, super charm, and so it goes on to infinity. Because we are dealing with a thing so abstract, so elusive in its own proportions, that we really never know whether we have one or not. Under these conditions, the only answer is to take hold of the matter. If you're not in that kind of trouble, stay out of it. And be grateful that it has been your wonderful privilege to be able to grow without seeing things. If you are seeing things, either have your eyes attended to immediately, or begin to dig into basic systems of thinking that are going to give you a dynamic, vital, meaningful pursuit in life. And under no conditions, if you are miserable, unhappy, defeated by life, run to some form of psychic phenomena for escape, because it is escape only into misery. If you can keep these thoughts rather clearly in mind, I think you will realize why it is not good to dabble with this sort of thing. From an experimental stage, it is very foolish. It is like experimenting with poisonous serpents or experimenting with some deadly material that is liable to explode in your face at any moment. Do not experiment. Do not play games with life. But realize that if you really want to make philosophy your journey, as Plotinus said, build a solid knowledge supporting a well-disciplined, well-integrated character. Then as you naturally grow and properly develop, any spiritual graces that you may require for your proper growth will be added unto you in due season. In this way, you won't have any trouble. Thank you very much.